This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room where the top experts, and in today's luxury edition of 56 Minutes, come together to understand one of the big issues of the day. Britain, we know about, but how has the rest of the world been coping with the pandemic? Who has suffered most and why? Who's got vaccines and who hasn't? And have countries learned how to cooperate better? Worldwide, it's been grim. More than 2.5 million people have died from COVID-19 over the last year. Tens of millions of others have been infected. As a species, we've been locked down, shut out, and thrown out of work. Inevitably, we know most about what's closest to home. But today, I want to understand better what has happened across the globe and why. Who has fared worst and best and why? Who's got vaccines and who hasn't? And how well has the world come together to fight the common threat? Step into the briefing room and we'll find out. First, I want to look at how the governments of different countries responded as an outbreak in Wuhan became a virus on the move. We'll start this in two very different countries. Let's begin with Laura Bicker, our correspondent in South Korea.
In January last year, when I saw people wearing face masks on the street and huge testing tents outside major hospitals, I thought the South Koreans were overreacting. At that point, the country only had a few cases. All of them had come from China. We foreigners in Seoul wondered what the Koreans knew that the rest of the world did not. It turned out they knew quite a lot. Doctors quickly understood that the virus could spread without showing symptoms in people. And that meant rapid testing was essential. Within a week of diagnosing the first case, South Korea produced a COVID-19 test kit. Within 2 weeks, the kit had been mass-produced and distributed around the country. These testing kits became one of South Korea's biggest exports. South Korea was also ready to hunt down the virus. Every patient who had tested positive for COVID-19 had their phone and bank records examined to track down where they'd been. That information was posted online. Contact trace teams were also deployed to find anyone who'd been near an infected patient to help them get a test and self-isolate. It all seemed a bit extreme and an invasion of privacy to someone unused to this level of surveillance. But most South Koreans viewed these measures as essential. This country had been hit by previous pandemics, and that's why it was better prepared when COVID-19 emerged. In just a matter of weeks, by early March, the number of cases fell from around 1,000 a day to just a handful. It was the world's first example of the effectiveness of test, track and trace during this pandemic. There have been missteps over the last year, and some restrictions on gathering remain in place, but there's been no countrywide lockdown. Restaurants, bars, businesses, even the karaoke bars in most places remain open. Strict quarantine at the border, along with the continuing test, track and trace measures, have not eradicated COVID-19, but they have kept the virus under control and allowed South Koreans to lead an almost normal life.
That was Laura Bicker. And now here's Will Grant in Mexico City.
As the pandemic first began to spread in Mexico, I have to confess to being in something of a haze. My early memories of COVID clouded by a lack of sleep. Our baby, Isla, was born in early January 2020, back when the only people around us wearing face masks were the doctors who delivered her. Yet even once the extent of the problem became clear, at no stage did the country's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, seem particularly worried. Last March, AMLO, as he's known, made a big show of hugging and kissing his supporters, especially their children, in the western state of Guerrero. By June, coronavirus-related deaths in Mexico stood at 17,000. Still, AMLO refused to wear a face mask or practice social distancing. At times, he appeared to be living in an alternate reality. He released an online video walking the wide halls of the National Palace in which he laid out his 10 commandments to emerge from coronavirus. Far from a list of stringent lockdown rules or bans on public gatherings, they included such gems as be happy and optimistic. I think the worst is over, he confidently claimed. It really wasn't. In fact, it was just getting started. Testing in Mexico was well below other nations, even within Latin America, making it hard to get a real picture of the crisis. Soon oxygen was so scarce that desperate family members began queuing night and day outside providers or buying tanks on the black market. The Health Ministry recently stated the official number of coronavirus-related deaths in the country is more than 200,000. But a day later, a government report gave the figure on excess deaths from COVID as around 60% higher, a staggering 320,000 lives lost since the pandemic began. Isla now runs, jumps, says words in Spanish and English, and knows an impressive array of animal noises. She is exactly as old as the pandemic itself, and it's all she's ever known. Many Mexicans now just hope AMLO's wildly inaccurate prediction last June that the worst is over at least starts to look true by this June.
Will Grant in Mexico City. Let's open out this discussion beyond those two countries. I'm joined now in the briefing room by Dr. Thomas Hale from Oxford University. He's been gathering global data on the pandemic using a tool called the Oxford COVID-19 Government Response Tracker. And Martin McKee, who's Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Tom Hale, we've just heard two very different experiences. Now, more generally, in terms of deaths and serious illness over the period of the pandemic, when you look between countries, how important has speed of action been?
To my mind, acting fast is the single most important thing. And we now can see, looking back on a year of evidence, many studies that show that to be exactly true, that those governments that acted sooner tended to see better results. If you look across Europe, you see a really interesting example of this because the disease came to different European countries at different times, but they all tended to act more or less around the same middle of March period. That meant that some were sort of ahead of the curve and some were quite behind it. Those that were ahead of the curve at that time, like Romania, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, all of that spring 2020 time period managed to keep their cases, their deaths, their hospitalizations lower than many Western European countries did in those same months. A speedy action in the spring really mattered.
We've seen these waves of infection and death. Which countries have been the most successful in keeping that original curve flat once they'd flattened it?
So there's a few different groups of countries I think are useful to look at here. Those countries that were, got a first wave but then managed to suppress it and keep it suppressed are the ones we're really interested in. These are countries that I think many people will know about, like New Zealand or Australia or China, for that matter. And actually, they tended to have a fairly similar set of responses in some ways. They were able to suppress that first wave with different kinds of closure and containment measures. They were able to use testing and contact tracing And they had strict border controls to make sure they weren't importing cases inadvertently. But there were also plenty of other countries that were able to suppress, if not eliminate, the disease in other ways. Countries like South Korea or Senegal or Finland, three very different kinds of countries, were also able to bring those first waves under control and to keep them at a level where they're not putting stress on the health system. And then the final group of countries, which I think is maybe even the most interesting, are those that never even had one wave, or at least had very tiny outbreaks compared to the size of the population. Vietnam, Thailand, Mongolia are all good examples here. And again, those kinds of countries use the same sorts of recipes. Testing and contact tracing, often at the community level, firm suppression when little flare-ups occur, and strict border controls to make sure there aren't any surprises.
Some of these waves have been pretty big, haven't they? I mean, you take the infection right the way down and then it has gone right the way back up again.
Absolutely. So we can think of these kinds of countries as roller coaster countries because they've seen not one, but two or three or maybe even four spikes of disease, depending on how you count. And yeah, sometimes those spikes have been really significant. Looking just at deaths, you see similar peaks in the spring and fall of the Northern Hemisphere last year in a number of European countries. So that suggests we're really on this roller coaster, as we said. And that's really worrisome because it means we're not necessarily making as much progress as we might hope to.
What characterizes a roller coaster country in your view?
So I think a roller coaster country is one that has basically not been able to do what an Australia or New Zealand or China has done, which is to consolidate the gains of suppression in the first instance. There are really, in my mind, three things that the roller coaster countries have done that have given them a second or third or fourth spike. One, they've often rolled back too quickly. So, for example, in the United States, we saw a number of the southern or western states begin to roll back their measures quite early in spring of 2020, even before they had experienced the first spread of disease locally. So they were rolling them back at exactly the wrong moment, just as the disease was really expanding in those parts of the United States. So rolling back too quickly is one problem. But also, you know, failing to use the time that lockdowns buy you is, to my mind, a really maybe the most important part of it. Lockdown isn't really a solution, right? You're not going to, in many parts of the world, fully get rid of the virus, but you can buy yourself some time to put in place measures like contact tracing, testing, isolation systems, other kinds of resilience measures to make sure that when the wave surges back up, you're better prepared. And yeah, again, many countries haven't been able to use that time well. And final point, you know, a lot of these lockdown measures that countries have been putting on were done successfully in the first round, but then were not as successful in the second round. And I think a reason for that is that many governments have seen decreasing policy space. They face more political opposition as measures sort of stretch over time. And so when it became time to act again, they faced more opposition to doing so. Perhaps the Eastern European countries I mentioned before are a good example of that because they were very late to lock down again in the fall, significantly behind many of the Western European countries, and saw significantly worse effects in terms of cases and hospitalizations and ultimately deaths. So locking down again too late is another reason for being on this roller coaster.
Martin McKee, let's talk now about health systems and the contribution that health systems have made to the progress of the pandemic. What do you think you can say about the link between health infrastructure and pandemic outcomes?
At one level, it seems obvious that having a better health infrastructure is a good idea because clearly you reduce the risk of running out of all the things that are necessary to provide treatment during a surge in cases. But it's actually more important than that because the knowledge that your health system is unlikely to be overwhelmed is hugely important in planning your response. Quite simply, you don't have the same constraints in a country where the health system is always teetering on the brink. So, for example, the United Kingdom, we've always known that the NHS has been just about coping. We run our hospitals at 95, 98% occupancy. This is not the case in a number of other countries. And we looked a number of years ago at a spike in deaths in January 2015, which seemed to be due to essentially the system falling over very briefly and not being able to cope. And that was a similar situation that we saw in Northern Italy. Whenever hospitals get to a very, very high level of workload, then they just don't have that flexibility to respond. So I think it's important in terms of your ability to have the bandwidth to look at the other issues that need to be taken into account rather than constantly worrying about the health system being overwhelmed.
Do you mean by that that you immediately feel the effects of a pandemic in a worse way if you don't have the spare capacity?
You do, and we could see the situation by contrasting Italy with Germany in the early phases. The hospitals in northern Italy were really running out of space. They were running out of all sorts of things. They were really struggling. Whereas in Germany, where you've got some of the highest level of intensive care capacity in Europe, you just didn't have to worry about that to the same extent. And they were able to focus very much on ramping up their testing, for example, and getting all of the other things in place.
You also pay a price, don't you, in terms of the health outcomes for other patients who can't, for one reason or other, be treated?
You absolutely do. And I think we see this particularly when we compare what happened in Europe with countries in Southeast Asia, the ones that had experience of SARS. They had invested very heavily in redesigning their health facilities, their hospitals, so they were in a position where they could keep patients that were potentially infected separate from other ones. By that means, they were able to continue other forms of care to a greater extent. Of course, they also had the advantage that they didn't have anything like as many cases.
Let's talk about how governmental systems may have impacted upon the pandemic. What do you think, looking overall, we can say about the differences in outcomes between different sorts of regimes?
I think it's important to recognise that while some authoritarian regimes like China and Vietnam have done very well, others that would be viewed as exemplars of democracy, such as Finland or New Zealand or Uruguay, have also done very well. Now, there is a lot of research looking at the link between political systems and COVID responses, both internationally and quite interesting work within the 50 United States, which are another interesting natural laboratory. What we do see is that countries that have had more egalitarian policies do seem to have done rather better. We also have seen work, which we've done and others have done, which shows that countries that were led by populist leaders who were appealing to their followers rather than looking at the science do seem to have done substantially worse.
By egalitarian, what do we mean?
More egalitarian countries that have got stronger social safety nets, that have better employment policies in terms of reducing the informal, the gig economy, they have been much more resilient.
Now, we're coming on to some of that later, but we heard from Will Grant from Mexico about a politician like López Obrador, whose attitude towards the pandemic almost from the beginning was almost dismissive, almost as if it was a kind of element of personal pride to him not to take it over seriously. How do we factor something like political leadership in?
It's hugely important. And if we look at the countries that have done worse, many of them are led by people like that. And of course, it's not just Mexico. Brazil is really the case study of a country that is doing disastrously at the minute. Now, of course, this has huge implications for the people who live in those countries, but it also has implications for the rest of the world, because as the virus is being transmitted so intensely in those countries, it is mutating, and that has consequences elsewhere. And I think after the pandemic, the world is going to have to start to look at what you do when a country is led by a politician whose actions are threatening the safety of the world.
Martin McKee there with Thomas Hale. It's not just been a health crisis, of course. The economies of the world have taken a battering. So how have different governments tried to minimise the damage, and with what degree of success? Once again, we'll kick this off with reports from two correspondents, later from India, but first, Anthony Zerker in the United States.
Americans may have been slow to acknowledge the reality of the coronavirus pandemic, but when it hit fast and hard. As retailers shuttered, revenues plummeted, the stock market crashed, and the travel and hospitality industries were devastated. Washington's political apparatus, which usually operates at an unreliable grind, moved with surprising speed as the nation began to feel the full economic brunt of the pandemic. Congress's solution was to shovel truly astounding amounts of money at the problem. In late March 2020, Congress approved a package that totaled about $2 trillion in new spending. It gave $550 billion in financial assistance to companies and local governments, $290 billion in direct payments of $1,200 a person to most Americans, and $270 billion to expand benefits to unemployed workers. The next month, Congress doled out $400 billion in guaranteed low-interest loans to encourage small businesses not to lay off their employees. In December, Congress dropped another $800 billion in business and unemployment aid, as well as more direct payments to Americans. Most recently, Congress, at the behest of the Biden administration, opened the checkbook again. $1.9 trillion in direct payments, extended unemployment, aid to state and local governments, small business assistance, and support to schools trying to reopen. The U.S. has spent more on coronavirus relief than any other nation in the world. As a share of its gross domestic product, the U.S. has spent 27%, second only to Japan. Some economists and policymakers have expressed concern that the spending is too much, that it will drive up inflation and burden the nation with massive new debt. Others have said it's not enough, and that much of the money has been wasted or misallocated. And while last year's aid packages had bipartisan support, the latest round was passed by Democrats without any Republican backing. The political battle lines in the U.S. are forming once again, even as the crisis has yet to fully pass. There will be a generation of Americans, however, who have witnessed an astounding level of government intervention in the face of a global crisis. The pandemic has left scars, political, economic, and cultural, but it will also leave memories of what the government here is capable of when politicians have no choice but to act.
Anthony Zerker there. Now to Delhi and Geeta Pandey.
Just over a year ago, Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced a nationwide lockdown to halt the spread of the pandemic. People were told they were no longer allowed to leave their homes. At the time, India had reported 519 cases of COVID-19 and 9 deaths. Mr. Modi appealed to people not to panic, but the announcement of the lockdown with barely 4 hours' notice unleashed chaos. Fearing shortages, crowds mobbed shops and pharmacies across the country. The morning after the announcement, Delhi's biggest bus terminal was closed with armed paramilitaries standing guard. On nearby roads, I saw hundreds of men, women, and children standing around in clusters. Almost all of the people I spoke to told me they were migrant workers, many of them employed on building sites or as domestic staff, drivers, and gardeners. With their workplaces shut, they were left stranded, far from home, with no jobs and little money. So they wanted to return to their villages. Over the next few days, their numbers grew. And with trains and bus services halted, millions began walking home, sometimes hundreds of miles. Many died on the way in accidents or from hunger and exhaustion. Critics blamed a lack of planning by the government for the chaos. One said the mismanagement of the migrant crisis and the treatment of its poorest citizens during the pandemic was India's shame. The lockdown ravaged India's economy, shrinking its GDP and adding to the distress of a banking sector that was already in crisis. Millions of small businesses shut down, and tens of millions lost their jobs. The government announced 3 stimulus packages, totaling $410 billion. But compare that to the trillions spent by the United States, a country with a quarter of the population of India. Now India is witnessing a second wave of the pandemic. And even though the government has ruled out a second lockdown, there are reports of migrant workers leaving cities to return home, just in case there's a wider shutdown.
Geeta Pandey in Delhi. To discuss the economics of the pandemic, I'm joined now in the briefing room by Nazmira Moola, an economist from South Africa. She helps run the Emerging Africa Infrastructure Fund. And also Monica DeBol from the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. Monica DeBol, we've heard from two very different places just now. Now, insofar as we can make any comparisons at all, which countries have been worst hit economically by COVID?
So in general, the countries that have fared worst are A, countries obviously who haven't been able to get their epidemics under control, but B, those countries that depend a lot on international trade, because supply chains during this whole past year of the pandemic have been very disrupted. So in Latin America, there are some which are big economies and have their own domestic markets, you know, Brazil being the largest, Mexico, but the rest of the countries in Latin America to one degree or another are very highly dependent on international trade. That is certainly the case of Chile. That is also the case of Uruguay. But we also have countries in Africa, for example, that do depend a lot on exports and imports. So these countries are not getting what they need for their economies, not are they being able to sell what they need to sell. Also, you have many countries in Latin America that are dependent on remittances, money that's sent home from nationals who are abroad. But these people have lost their jobs because many of them work in the services sector. And of course, the services sector is very hard hit by the pandemic. We have not seen these remittances materialize. And so that's been a major shortfall and a major economic shock to those.
Okay, so let's look at the countries that have done really badly where the pandemic's not been under control. Where are we talking about there?
Many countries, but with very few exceptions, every single country in Latin America has been hurt deeply. One such country is Brazil, the worst country when it comes to daily death rates and things like that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think what we have seen is that if you have a public health problem that is really completely out of control, that disrupts the economy in a lot of different ways. Even if you do not have lockdowns in place because people are scared, people are afraid, and so are companies. Companies are going to fire people anyway, so unemployment's going to go up. And on the other hand, you know, a lot of people are going to be reluctant to get out of their houses. And so that just disrupts the entire functioning of the economy. You can't have a public health problem that is not resolved and think that the economy is going to be doing just fine. It just doesn't work that way.
And Nazmira Mulla, obviously, many poorer countries in Africa simply haven't had the resources to support economies in the way that rich countries can. What's been the effect of not being able to put in support?
Those countries that have had fiscal capacity to support their economies, to stimulate through the downturn, have had shallower recessions and have come out of it in a better position. And what you see in most of Africa is very limited ability to do that, including South Africa, entered into COVID with very little in the way of fiscal buffers. So what you saw was very little stimulus from the government to support through COVID. And if you contrast that to a country like the UK, where massive amounts of stimulus were injected, you see ultimately there's been less damage done.
Now, that's very interesting because one of the things that we've been told constantly here is with interest rates so low, you can afford to borrow huge amounts at relatively low levels of interest. Why can't a country like South Africa borrow in the way that a country like Britain can?
The main reason is the market does not provide the same luxury to emerging markets in general that it provides to developed markets. Developed markets in general are given the benefit of the doubt that they will pay back this debt. Whereas emerging markets in general, but particularly those that have entered into COVID with a rising debt to GDP level, the market's much more skeptical. So instead of a government borrowing at sub 1% or sub 2%, South African government is borrowing at 8%. That's a very different equation.
It is a very different equation. If you can't do, let's say, what we did here in the UK, which is to offer a furlough to people or support to people who have lost their jobs, has that impacted on their ability to actually maintain a lockdown?
So South Africa started off with a very harsh lockdown. And no, that wasn't maintained for much beyond the initial 5 weeks. You saw a gradual loosening. And what was very interesting is the second wave, which we had through late December into January, there was much more moderate tightening of the controls by the government because there was this clear realization that they couldn't afford the economic damage. And that is something we're seeing across emerging markets right now. But let me give you another perspective. Lockdowns in emerging markets work very differently to lockdowns in developed markets where there is social distancing in the home. In emerging markets, you have many people living in very small spaces, and therefore lockdowns in poor communities in emerging markets actually spread the disease. They don't contain the disease.
Now, Monica, can I ask you this question? Is it therefore the case that the countries which will recover the quickest are the countries, firstly, that were wealthy enough to be able to borrow significantly without incurring huge charges, and secondly, those that were marginally less dependent upon international trade.
I think that's a fair assessment. I would add to that, obviously, countries that were able to control their epidemics and have had the ability to vaccinate their populations, which, you know, a lot of emerging markets are struggling with. So vaccinations are really key to these countries' recoveries. And I think across the emerging world, we are not seeing that happen. So that is concerning.
Nazmir, a really difficult question, this one. As far as you can tell, what will be the long-term economic consequences from COVID? And I suppose what I'm asking, has it set some countries back many years in their development and economic programs?
I think that the fiscal constraints COVID has introduced through the plunge in tax revenue, so the shrinkage in GDP has resulted in a fall in tax revenues, and therefore that limits the government's ability to do things like invest in infrastructure, which is so important to help long-term growth. I think that impact will be quite long-lasting, David. I think the question is whether some of these countries use the opportunity to implement self-help. So if you entered into it without a clear growth plan, then you need to actually implement one at this point in time. For example, if I use South Africa right now, the decisions that have been made through COVID were decisions the government was not prepared to make prior to COVID. And if they can just do a bit more, we could actually come out of this crisis with a very strong boost to growth going forward. But that requires the government to continue making hard decisions. So getting over long-held government ideologies through the crisis of COVID in order to facilitate growth going forward.
So this is a kind of, if you like, a response to catastrophe. If normal circumstances won't make you make necessary changes, then maybe a disaster will.
Governments hate implementing reforms because there's always a loser. And this is not just emerging markets. This is across the world. They hate implementing reforms. So they need to be forced to implement reforms. And I'm saying if we're trying to find some silver lining in this horrible storm of COVID, it would be that it forces reforms to be implemented that otherwise wouldn't have happened.
Monica, whatever the silver linings might be, the actual outlook for some of these countries at the moment, left to themselves entirely, looks rather bleak. Are we essentially looking at the need for an international program of assistance to countries that come out of the pandemic extremely badly?
I think we are. I think we're already very far behind in terms of international cooperation throughout this whole process. We've been seeing that with the vaccines. You know, rich countries have vaccines. Middle-income and poor countries don't have vaccines. And, you know, as long as you have a portion of the world that is in that situation and won't be able to vaccinate their populations, as we were saying before, these countries are just going to suffer the economic pain for, you know, a much longer period of time, let alone all of the other issues that these countries are facing anyway.
Monica Dibol with Nazmir Amula. You're listening to a special extended edition of The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In Britain, the speed of our vaccine rollout is allowing the easing of lockdown restrictions. Hooray for us. But what's happening with vaccination in the rest of the world? Before we discuss that, we're going to hear from two more of our correspondents, this time in Kenya, and first, Tom Bateman in Israel.
The first person to get the vaccine in Israel was a man in his 70s from Jerusalem. He was remarkably at ease, rolling up his sleeve in front of the TV cameras. A small injection for man, a giant leap for the health of us all, he declared. This was Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, setting the example in being number one, he said, amid worries about vaccine scepticism. Since then, this small country of 9 million has rolled out vaccines at the world's fastest rate. By late March, more than half the population had received two doses. It seems to be sustaining dramatic results, despite the economy reopening. The reproduction, or R rate, had dropped to just over 0.5 by last week. The rate measures how many people one infected person passes the virus onto. Death rates have dropped significantly. COVID-19 is currently in retreat in Israel. The Speedy campaign has much to do with a universal, digitised health system. I've covered the COVID monitoring hospital rooms and spoken to many doctors this last year. It is truly impressive. But the success owes more to vaccine procurement politics. Mr. Netanyahu did a deal with the boss of Pfizer, Albert Bourla. Israel gets its big daily supply of doses in return for passing on anonymized health data to the pharma firm. But it's been wrapped up in controversy too. Human rights groups point to a painfully slow vaccine rollout for 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. They say Israel, as the occupying power, has responsibility. The Israeli government denies this, saying the Oslo peace accords hand such jobs to the Palestinian Authority, which has limited self-rule. It has struggled to procure doses, and most Palestinians are still waiting. Israel has, though, immunized 100,000 who have Israeli work permits. There are plenty of unanswered questions about vaccine effectiveness here. The Middle East is a baby booming place. About a third of Israelis are under 16, and it'll be months before children can be vaccinated. How will that affect the virus's spread? And the country is opening up rapidly. There is a so-called Green Pass vaccine certificate for getting into hotels and gyms, bars and the like. But it's not always being enforced. I've seen a number of places not bothering to ask. Israel lurched out of its first lockdown and saw infection rates surge. The government was accused of botching it. This time, the vaccine scientists have come to the rescue, hopefully.
Tom Bateman there in Jerusalem. And now from Nairobi, here's Rhoda Odhiambo.
My friends and colleagues say that I am married to COVID-19. This is because I started reporting about it in January last year. And it feels like that's all I've reported on in the past 15 months. Back in January, there were no known cases in Kenya or in the rest of the continent. Kenya has now reported more than 130,000. With a population of about 50 million, that might not sound like much, but for a country that has limited healthcare resources, it's a lot. I was at the airport in Nairobi when the first consignment of vaccines arrived at the beginning of March. It was quite a party. Officials from UNICEF and WHO are there, as well as the country's health minister. And there were a lot of journalists, all scrambling for the best place to get the perfect picture of the plane that had just landed. Kenya has received just over 1 million doses so far from the COVAX facility, the global initiative that's aimed at giving fair access to the vaccines to everyone, rich or poor. This was a sign of hope for everyone in Kenya, and the Kenyan government had a plan for who would get the vaccine first. Key among them were healthcare workers, teachers, police officers, and the elderly. The trouble is, as soon as the vaccines arrived and were distributed to different cities, young people started rushing to health facilities to see if they could get an injection. Some of them succeeded, others were turned away by hospitals, where the health workers were following the letter of the law. Other Kenyans are using their connections to jump the queue. You can understand why they are doing this, but it does mean that people in the priority groups risk missing out. Of course, Kenya is going to need many more than 1 million doses if it's going to vaccinate everyone. The COVAX consignments come from India, and the next one is due at the airport in May. But infection rates in India are rising, and India has suspended the export of vaccines, at least for the time being, saying it needs to prioritize on its own population. So people in Kenya and other African countries may have to wait a little longer for their first dose. Meanwhile, five cities here, including the capital Nairobi, are back on lockdown, and many hospitals are overwhelmed by patients severely ill with COVID-19. A lack of supplemental oxygen in hospitals just adds to the problems.
Rhoda Odhiambo. So can you have security from the virus while much of the world is unvaccinated? Joining me in the briefing room to discuss the vaccination rollout is Dr. Jerome Kim. He's the head of the International Vaccine Institute in South Korea. And Rasmus Beck-Hansen, who runs an organisation in London, a science analytics company called Airfinity. Rasmus Hansen, some rich countries have done really well in developing and distributing vaccines. We've heard about Israel. Others not so well. Now, what are the factors, the general factors, that you can see having made a difference?
I think one of the really key factors is whether these countries treated this as a national security risk from the beginning, or if they more treated it as a kind of a health challenge. If you look at countries like the US, the UK, Israel, and also a country like Chile, these countries have by far the highest vaccinations per capita now. All of these had deep involvement of their military from the very beginning of the pandemic. And I think it makes a lot of sense for a country to think about a pandemic as a kind of a national security, as a military risk, both if you think about the type of threat, but also the type of response needed. In many ways, a virus is a bit out of the blue. It requires very fast mobilization, fast investment in scaling up capabilities. And then when you look at the rollout of the vaccine, it also requires a logistical setup that is very complicated and typically something that a strong military would be well suited for. So I think both on the funding side, everything from the early funding to the rollout, the military has played a really big role. And I think that's somewhat underestimated. But I think that's one of the key factors that explains why some of these countries have done well and others not so well. I mean, if you look at the EU, for instance, EU's challenge is that the military is not under the EU's remit. So some of the things that would have been needed for a more rapid response for the EU countries are simply not available to them.
That's really fascinating. Dr. Jerome Kim, my understanding, as we broaden out the question of vaccination from the countries that have done best, usually wealthier countries, is that it still matters to them what happens elsewhere in the world, because high levels of COVID anywhere risk creating the conditions for variants to be created that might not be susceptible to existing vaccines. Is that broadly the reason why, say, we in the UK should care very much about what is happening to COVID in other countries?
Yes, so I think you can answer that question on three different levels. The first is a purely humanitarian one. We know that if the high-income countries unilaterally use the first 2 billion doses of vaccine, that global COVID deaths will likely double. So right now, 2.7 million, 5.4 million deaths would be unspeakable. And the second is economic. High-income countries will face an additional burden of $4 to $5 trillion due to the inequities in distribution and the prolongation of the pandemic in other parts of the world. And then finally, the biological one is exactly as you said, uncontrolled outbreaks that we have very little knowledge of because they're occurring in places that don't do a lot of testing will lead to the generation of variants, which in the end requires us to invent a whole new set of vaccines. So we're doing what we do for a number of different reasons, and we have to look at the big picture.
So, Jerome Kim, pushing on what you've just said, when we've just heard a postcard from Kenya that talks about how they got 1 million doses. Their next 1 million doses are not due till May. I call that difficulties. Can you tell us about global efforts, therefore, to make sure that everyone has access to a vaccine? And I think we're going to have to tell people what COVAX is here at this point.
COVAX is an organization to which 190 countries have now signed up. And the intent of COVAX is to provide 2 billion doses, roughly 20% of the supply needed by the countries that participate. And that will allow the countries to vaccinate the people at highest risk. 90 countries, so half of those, will not be paying for the vaccine at all. So this is really an effort by high-income countries and middle-income countries to support vaccination of everyone in the world. And it's really one of the first times we've ever had access to innovative vaccine technology available in the first year of introduction in high-income countries and then also being available in low- and middle-income countries. So if it works, it will be a mechanism for us to move global health vaccines forward and save, you know, millions of more lives, not only from COVID.
Rasmus Hansen, from your perspective, how could the COVAX effort be strengthened? Because it seems pretty clear that at the moment what's happening is patchy.
Yeah, I mean, COVAX's big challenge is that there's simply not enough vaccines for them, right? So we have currently now produced around 1 billion doses of vaccines. And the pattern we are seeing is that the Western countries, in particular the US, are taking the vaccines they're producing to themselves, which is really not surprising when you look at the infection rates both there and in Europe. You can argue that in some ways it does make sense that the countries with the highest infection rates are also the ones who are vaccinating their people first. But it's just put COVAX in a difficult situation. It's been compounded by the fact that the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is really the cornerstone in the COVAX program, has suffered from some delays. So COVAX have simply not had that. They don't have the vaccines to distribute. So what has happened instead is China, who has had very low infection rates and actually has very high production numbers of vaccines, have emerged as kind of a vaccine superpower, a little bit out of the blue, I think. China is then kind of stepping in a little bit where COVAX was supposed to step in. So a lot of the countries, instead of waiting for COVAX to distribute their vaccines, they're striking these bilateral deals, which is to some extent undermining the COVAX initiative. I think a lot of this will change come fall and early next year when we have more doses available. And maybe China will also join the COVAX initiative. And I think it's definitely also made a difference that the Biden administration is now more firmly behind it. But at the moment, it is a challenging situation for COVAX, no doubt about that.
I was wondering, Jerome Kim, whether in principle Western countries which have vaccinated all their vulnerable groups and people over 50, whether there's an argument, but maybe it's impossible, should slow down their programs so that the doses that they could have available are made available elsewhere?
That is a key question. And it's difficult for countries that have embarked on a program of aggressive vaccination to back off because it sends confusing messages around the need for vaccination. The United States has released AstraZeneca vaccine, I believe, to Canada and Mexico. And a group of four countries, the United States, Japan, India, and Australia, are putting together a billion doses for Southeast Asia. Now, again, this is a good way to undermine the multilateral efforts of COVAX and efforts that really will, in 2022, start to target countries by need. We really, right now, when vaccine supplies are limited, need to get as much vaccine out as quickly as possible and to distribute it through the multilateral mechanism rather than striking one-off deals. And I think the point is very good that the Chinese have stepped in, but the Chinese are having production problems also. And, you know, Chinese vaccines are still not approved by the World Health Organization.
Can I just ask a quick question about the character of the pandemic and therefore of the vaccination challenge in a continent like Africa, where we've had incredibly low rates of infections? Now, is this a delay and it will come, or is this a factor of the age population profile in large numbers of countries?
We don't really actually have the data that we need. When you look at the number of infections and deaths in Kenya, it, you know, is about 100,000. When you look at the number of people in a blood bank survey, 5 to 7% of Kenyans have been infected, which is millions of people. So part of it is that we're not necessarily making the diagnoses, which means that there could be large epidemics that we don't know anything about, generating mutants that, again, we don't know anything about. So I think that one of the things that we have to do as a priority is put diagnostic capability into the parts of the world where we don't see a lot of COVID infections to make sure that we are actually picking up epidemics and that we can prioritize properly. We can send vaccine where it's needed, but we can't do that if we don't have the information.
Jerome Kim there and Rasmus Beck Hansen. It's obvious that a truly successful distribution of COVID-19 vaccines depends on a high degree of global cooperation. So how good at cooperating has the world become over the course of the pandemic? And is it good enough now? Joining me is Dr. Jennifer Cole from Royal Holloway, University of London, and co-author of a recent report on global cooperation and the pandemic. Jennifer Cole, something struck me forcibly recently, looking particularly at what's going on in France and Germany, which is, we've all had the same virus, albeit with variants, and yet different countries and even different parts of different countries have all done and are still doing different things. Now, why?
There is no best way to do it. Nobody's really gone through anything like this before, so there isn't really any textbook response or kind of template response. And countries, therefore, have to be making decisions as they go along and with no right or wrong answer. Everybody is trying what they can and figuring out what works and doesn't work as they go along.
So there have been points of difference. Let's now look at cooperation. Now, in your estimation, how well have governments and individuals managed to cooperate during the pandemic?
There's been cooperation at some levels and less cooperation on others. The scientific community has cooperated remarkably well. The amount of sharing of information, sharing of knowledge, sharing of genome sequences between scientific laboratories and universities has been amazing. And the speed with which we've been able to develop the vaccines has been due to that. What we've seen at a more political level is, and again, perhaps not surprisingly, countries perhaps putting the interests of their own people first above international goods. It's interesting to look at that because cooperation as we go forward, the difference between politicians who are really quite often on kind of short-term contracts, essentially. So they're always looking for the easy wins and to do not necessarily what's best, but what's going to get them the next votes, as opposed to the scientific community that doesn't really have that time pressure on it.
The scientific community has cooperated. Have the health organisations in different countries also cooperated?
There isn't really a mechanism or need for them to cooperate with each other across borders. They cooperate with the World Health Organization.
You mentioned the World Health Organization, the global organisation dedicated to the promotion of public health everywhere. How well can we say it has performed in the past year?
The World Health Organization is a coordinating body. It's not a response organization. So, for instance, if you look at it in comparison to NATO, one thing you could say is, should a global pandemic be seen as the equivalent of a nuclear strike? But that's not what the World Health Organization is. And it's woefully underfunded. Most of the countries that make financial commitments to the World Health Organization don't follow through on them, America being one of the worst offenders. And what that leaves, which is kind of interesting in the international arena as well, is it then leaves international philanthropists and people like Bill Gates and the Jack Ma Foundation. It's very admirable that there are private individuals who are prepared to fill that gap. But should it be left to private individuals or should it be an international public good?
If we did put large amounts more money into the World Health Organization, what more would it do with that money? What would be the things that it could achieve that it can't achieve now?
I think, first of all, it would be able to have more of a response mechanism. So it would be able to more easily support countries and actually have, you know, experts and task forces who could go in immediately and to help countries work out what was happening within their own borders.
I'm trying to imagine the range of extra competencies that we think it should have, or capabilities that it should have in a situation like this?
I don't think it's necessarily any more competencies. I mean, I think it's been phenomenally competent in the information it's had, sharing the genomes, helping vaccine development. The problem is it cannot tell countries to do anything, trying to lock down very hard. The obvious message for the World Health Organization to have given to the world was, please look at what China's doing and do the same. And essentially, that's the message they did give, and nobody took any notice of it. Cooperation is only as good as the political ecology in which they operate. The World Health Organization is an organization that has to operate in a political world. What it can do within that political world is limited by the actions of the politicians.
Jennifer Cole. For the final part of the programme, I want to try and think big about the global outcome of this extraordinary period. How will it help shape the world? To assist us here, I have Kishore Mahbubani, a former diplomat who was twice the permanent representative of the United Nations for Singapore and is Distinguished Fellow at the Asia Research Institute. Professor Mahbubani, how well do you judge the world to have cooperated over the pandemic?
Very badly, because right now we have in the world, unfortunately coinciding with the outbreak of COVID-19, the biggest geopolitical contest that has broken out in human history between the United States and China. And the logical thing for United States and China to have done should have been to press the pause button on the geopolitical contest and work together to eliminate COVID-19. Instead, as you could see under the Trump administration, the opposite happened. So we missed lots of opportunities for cooperation, and lots of lives could have been saved if there had been better international cooperation during COVID-19.
Now, seen from Singapore, from your vantage point, if you look at the impact of the pandemic on the geopolitical situation that already existed and then push it forward, what do you think we can say about what has happened?
I would say the COVID-19 has essentially accelerated the arrival of the Asian century. I mean, the Asian century was going to happen anyway, but COVID-19 accelerated the process, because I can tell you that most Asians are absolutely shocked at the incompetence of the Western governments in handling COVID-19. And it shows that in many ways, to put it very bluntly, Asian societies have become more competent. And sadly, and I say this as a friend of the West, Western societies have become less competent. And so it sort of indicates that the power shift to Asia will accelerate.
Now, one of the reasons we've heard adduced as to why you might get this discrepancy essentially is a commitment to individualism and personal liberty in the West, which is not really easily consistent with very stark measures to deal with something like the pandemic. Are you saying that it is that outlook which actually will be increasingly challenged on a global level, not just in China, but a global level, as a consequence of the pandemic?
Absolutely. And, you know, I was ambassador to the UN in 1998, when the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was celebrated. And Helmut Schmidt, the former German chancellor, proposed that we should have a universal declaration of human responsibilities to accompany the universal declaration of human rights. Sadly, the Western countries rejected his proposal. And I think that reflects the fact that in Western societies, they have, in a sense, lost track of the most essential truth of the human condition, which is that to succeed, societies must take care of the individual, and societies must take care of the society at large too. And that's something that is emerging as a competitive advantage in Asia, because in Asia, there's always been the belief that you must take care of the collective before you just take care of the individual.
The picture that you paint is of a society which it would be difficult to attain in many Western countries. Let's imagine for a moment that we struggle with that, try and work out ways of doing it and so on. If we push down 10 years' time, what do you think we will say was the great consequence of the period of pandemic in geopolitical terms?
Well, I would say that China is definitely going to become the number one power in the world. China was always going to become number one. But the Chinese, I can tell you this, didn't have the confidence. They were not sure that they could achieve it. But after they watched how disastrously the United States has handled COVID-19, how badly the European Union has handled COVID-19, the Chinese have lost their natural deference to the West, and the Chinese have had an explosion of cultural confidence. So with this burst of confidence, I think they'll be much more confident that they will succeed in becoming number one. And COVID-19 has convinced them of that.
Kishore Mahbubani, even in the time available, you can only scratch the surface of this extraordinary period. But thanks to all my guests who've helped me to get even that far. Until next time, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Paul Moss and Kirstine Knight. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's the edition in which we investigated the mystery of short selling and the role of hedge funds. There's the one about whether there might soon be a referendum on the reunification of Ireland, and one that investigated the initial economic consequences of Britain having left the European Union.
Hello, I'm Vanessa Casile. And there is nothing I love more than a great documentary.
I'm woken by the sound of gunfire.
There's something about a true story, told well that changes your perspective on the world.
He trusted the wrong people, and it's obviously cost him his life.
Radio 4 is home to the world's greatest audio documentaries.
A film showing bright pink bottoms sitting on Victoria sponge cakes is projected onto a screen over the stage.
And you can find the best of them all in one place, twice a week.
Although we can see and hear these animals, they're literally living their lives at a different speed to us.
The podcast is called Seriously. Subscribe now on the BBC Sounds app.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.